Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On October 11th, 1972, U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger introduced oral argument in one of the most consequential and controversial cases in American history.
First, in number 70, 18... Roe against Wade.
Arguing for legalization of abortion rights and on behalf of Jane Roe was Texas attorney Sarah Weddington.
Mrs. Weddington, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
She was 26 years old.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, we are once again before this court to ask relief against the continued enforcement of the Texas abortion statute.
That Texas statute at the time held that all abortions were illegal except those performed to save the life of the woman. Weddington argued that was unconstitutional.
We do not ask this court to rule that abortion is good or desirable in any particular situation. We are here to advocate that the decision as to whether or not a particular woman will continue to carry or will terminate a pregnancy is a decision that should be made by that individual. That in fact she has a constitutional right to make that decision for herself.
On January 22, 1973, the court issued its opinion. Seven of the justices agreed with Weddington, a decision that legalized abortion across the country. The fight over abortion never ended, of course. 44 years later, Roe v. Wade is one of the most simultaneously celebrated and reviled cases in U.S. history. It also defined Sarah Weddington's life and career. Weddington was honored by Harvard Law School this week in conjunction with International Women's Day. She joins us in the studio to talk about her life and about the continued debate over abortion rights today. Sarah Weddington, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Journalists have described you as maybe an unlikely person to get, at that time, to get fully involved in the manner that you did. Here's what one newspaper described you as, that you were hardly countercultural, middle class and married, the daughter of a Methodist minister, a person who headed her high school chapter of the Future Homemakers of America.
Now, I was also the drum major for the Canyon Junior High Band, and then I was the secretary of the freshman class at law school. You know, there were so few women then. When I was at Harvard Law School yesterday with some of their particularly women students and the dean, of course, who's a female, we were talking about the fact that at that point there were five women in my law school class out of about 150, 250. You know, it was, we were such a small group.
This was in the 1960s, mid-1960s?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah. There was a lot of change and a lot of thinking about challenging laws restricting reproductive rights in Texas.
Yeah.
So tell us the story then of how you eventually met up with Linda Coffey, who was your co-counsel.
She was another woman out of the five who was in my class in law school.
Yeah.
And so this group of mostly women, two men, we were talking in the law school lounge one day, and they said, you know, we're really worried we're going to get prosecuted as accomplices to the crime of abortion for sending people to various places. We really think we need to file a lawsuit. And so I said I'd research it, and I did, and I came back, and we met again. And they said to me, Sarah, what would you charge us to bring a case against this law? And I said, oh, I'd do it for free. And they said, you are our lawyer.
Now, in those early days, before the case began making its way through the court system, I mean, what was your initial thought about the legal basis on which to challenge abortion restrictions?
There had been one prior case that was Griswold versus Connecticut. It was a case really about contraception, where contraception was illegal. And a woman named Estelle Griswold, who was the director of the New Haven Planned Parenthood, and her doctor, a man named Lee Buxton, had given a contraceptive device, as it's described in the case, to a married couple. They were arrested, prosecuted, and convicted of being, giving contraception, which was illegal. So they filed suit against that, and they won their case based on the 14th Amendment, which was privacy, that a woman has a right of privacy to decide for herself whether to continue or terminate a pregnancy. And so that was the basic thing we argued. But to tell you the truth, we also argued the 1st, the 4th, the 5th, the 8th, the 9th, and the 14th Amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Supreme Court hearing, that one of the judges said, in other words, Miss Weddington, anywhere we'll find it is okay with you. And I said, yes, sir. But I thought the right of privacy would be the one.
You know, it's such a potent argument, and obviously it was a convincing one when the decision, the landmark decision, was issued by the Supreme Court in 1973. But as you well know, I mean, there are a lot of conservative legal scholars and anti-abortion activists who to this day insist that there is no right to privacy enumerated explicitly in the Constitution.
Well, and there's not the word privacy.
Yeah.
But when you put together what the people writing the Constitution were trying to do, keep the government out of determining the most vital parts of your life, then there was a right of privacy. And that's just the words the Supreme Court used to describe it. Blackmun was the person who wrote the opinion. He had been the medical, the legal counsel for Mayo Clinic before he went on the bench.
Yeah.
And so he was particularly concerned about doctors, the impact of these laws on doctors. And then doctors talked to him at Mayo Clinic about the tragedies that happened because of the laws. Because laws against abortion don't end abortion or keep them from happening. They just make them much more dangerous.
Yeah.
Parkland Hospital in Dallas is a very famous trauma hospital. That's where John F. Kennedy was taken when he was shot. And that hospital had a ward called the IOB ward, Infected Obstetrics. And it was basically for women who had done self-abortion, who had had illegal abortion, sometimes by people who had no skill and ended up really, you know, perforating and all kinds of problems. And so a lot of the doctors, almost all of them in that period, who were in law school ended up, if they were in Dallas, working in the IOB ward. So they spent a lot of time trying to save the fertility, trying to save the lives of women who were there because of abortion.
I want to talk with you in more detail about the legal path that you took to arguing Roe in the Supreme Court. But let me just step aside here for a second and ask about your own personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 1992, you wrote a memoir in which, for the first time,
mm-hmm.
I think you made public that you have direct experience with this question of abortion.
Right.
Can you tell us that story?
Sure. In the 60s, while I was in law school, I was dating a man, Ron Weddington, and became pregnant. And so I had to finish law school. I had to put him through law school. I had lots to do. And I just could not stop to have a pregnancy at that point. So Ron asked somebody who knew a name in Mexico. I remember it was $400 I had to give him. And we drove to Mexico, found his office. I can still remember thinking, oh, I hope I don't die. And even more than that, I hope no one ever finds out about this. You know, I look back now, it was so scary at the time. But I was back and at work and in school Monday morning.
Even with the cushion of many decades, it still sounds terrifying. I mean, having to, it does sound frightening to me, having to cross the border and put your life and health in the hands of someone you've never even met.
But you think about so many women that have had terrible experiences. I was one of the lucky ones because I had the money.
Well, how much of the fact that, I mean, even though you say you were one of the lucky ones and you had the money, you still had to go to extraordinary means to get this procedure. I mean, how much of your own personal experience is helped drive you to, you know, wanting to pursue Roe the way you and Linda Coffey did all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, certainly part of it, because I didn't want anybody else to ever have to go through that.
Now, you were 26 years mm-hmm. old when you presented your oral argument before the United mm-hmm. States Supreme Court. That fact in and of itself is quite remarkable to me.
I think so, too. And now I look back and think, oh, my gosh. But it's interesting because they still think around the Supreme Court that I was the youngest person ever to argue in the Supreme Court, man or woman.
And, I mean, also we should note at that time, all nine justices were men. Well.
Oh, yeah. And there were seven the first time. Then the second time we argued, it was nine men.
And why did it have to go back for that second time?
Well, the first time we argued, there were only seven justices. And there were a number of the judges who felt they should hold it until there were nine judges, because it was such an important and controversial case that it would be better to have the involvement of nine judges.
Well, we actually have some of the audio from the oral arguments that you gave before the Supreme Court. Again, the oral argument happened in 1972. The decision came out in 1973. So here's a little excerpt. This is where Justice Harry Blackmun is questioning you over what constitutes the rights of a fetus. Here we go.
But here we have a person, the woman, entitled to fundamental constitutional rights, as opposed to the fetus prior to birth, where there is no establishment of any kind of federal constitutional rights.
Well, do I get from this, then, that your case depends primarily on the proposition that the fetus has no constitutional rights?
It depends on saying that the woman has a fundamental constitutional right and that the state has not proved any compelling interest for regulation in the area. Even if the court at some point determined the fetus to be entitled to constitutional protection, you would still get back into the weighing of one life against another.
Help me understand, how did you feel when you were standing before those nine justices and you were making the oral argument? I mean, this sounds so silly, me asking you this, but I got to do it anyway. I mean, were you nervous?
Yes. And part of it was because the outcome of that case was so important. It was going to affect the lives of countless women and families across this country for years. And the only thing is, if you had said to me that day, you're still going to be talking about this in 44 plus years, I wouldn't have believed that.
When you found out that the case had been decided in your favor, it was 7-2, right?
Yes, because then we had nine judges. Right. And I had run for the legislature in Austin, Texas, because I didn't know if I was winning or losing the case. So we thought, well, if we don't win in the Supreme Court, at least you would be in the legislature and you could introduce legislation to make abortion legal in Texas. And we think we can get the votes to do it.
And when you found out that that
I was in the legislature, yeah. I was in the
Capitol.
What
was your reaction?
Well, first the phone rang and an assistant answered it, and it was a reporter from the New York Times. And that reporter said, "Does Miss Weddington have a comment today about Roe versus Wade?" The assistant who answered the phone said, "Should she?" And the reporter said, "It was decided today." And the assistant said, "How was it decided?" And the reporter said she won it 7-2. And that was so exciting, except just knowing I won but not knowing what the opinion said, what the grounds were. I couldn't really talk to the press much because I just said, oh, I'm so excited. But on what basis was this? So I called a friend in Washington, said, go to the court, get a copy of the opinion, read it, call me back, tell me what it says. And she did. So then the next day I started making comments.
Yeah. Now, Sarah Weddington, of course you know that Norma McCorvey, who was Jane Roe in Roe v. Wade, years after the case was decided, she underwent a total transformation in her view of abortion, and she ended her life being totally opposed to all abortions. That said, I wanted to ask you about your relationship with her during the time of the case, because in 1994— Norma McCorvey had this very interesting, powerful quotation in the New York Times. She was describing how in one of the first meetings she had with you in the early days of Roe v. Wade, that you had met her in a pizza parlor, and she was telling you that she desperately needed an abortion. Then she told the New York Times, quote, "She needed me to be pregnant for her case. I set Sarah Weddington up on a pedestal like a rose petal, but when it came my turn, well, Sarah saw these cuts on my wrists, my swollen eyes from crying, the miserable person sitting across from her, and she knew she had a patsy." Wow. She goes on and says, "She knew I wouldn't go outside the realm of her and Linda. I was too scared. It was one of the most hideous times of my life." So I wonder what your reaction is to that, that, you know, Norma McCorvey says that she was your patsy.
No, I really respected her for a long time because I had explained to her that pregnancies didn't take as long as cases did. And we would try to do the case as fast as we could and get a decision, but it was unlikely we would get it in time for her to have an abortion. And so we were very careful to explain those things. But the fact that she seemed to have thought now that I should tell her where an abortion was, which was illegal, and probably pay for it because she didn't have any money. No, I'm not going to tell my clients to go do illegal things.
You know, Sarah Weddington, one of the reasons why I just wanted to touch on Norma McCorvey's own transformation in regarding her view on abortion is I think it's sort of emblematic on how unsettled the nation as a whole still feels. I mean, Roe happened, it's still legal, but obviously abortion is one of the most controversial issues in the United States today. I mean, we were looking at state-by-state statistics and found that some 22 states right now in the United States have 6 or more abortion restrictions on the books. So I'm wondering, I mean, regardless of if another a case makes it all the way to the Supreme Court that challenges the constitutionality of Roe itself, it seems as if at the state level it may not even matter because there's been a very successful effort to make abortion access harder and harder. Does that concern you?
Oh, yes. You have a reduced number of doctors who are willing to help women who are in need of reproductive rights issues and abortion. And the more restrictions that are passed, the harder it is for them. In Texas, a lot of those restrictions have been passed in recent years. And so there are for a while, there were half the number of abortion clinics that there had been before those laws passed. Now they're even fewer. And so you're making it where women have to travel sometimes across the state, sometimes across state lines. And there was one time when Trump was being interviewed, and the interviewer said, well, what if a woman has to go across state lines? And he said, well, she just has to go across state lines. But that's someone talking who I think has a helicopter of his own and a plane of his own and a big retinue of cars and ways to go and the money. A lot of women don't have that.
Are you concerned that under a Trump administration, if we get more than just this one new Supreme Court seat, if we get some more substantial change in the court, that Roe could get overturned?
I'm worried about that, and partly because Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's one of the advocates for women being able to make their own decisions, is 83. There are another couple of the judges who are late 70s. One judge I'm concerned about but not frantic about, whereas if you ended up with several new judges, then that really concerns me, because if you look at who would be appointing them, who would be confirming them, we could have a situation where we might not be able to keep a majority.
Now, my final question to you, I mean, we've talked a lot about the legal arguments you made in front of the Supreme Court, but I think one of the reasons, maybe the reason why abortion remains such a contentious issue in the United States is that people have profound moral questions about it. So for those folks listening who currently believe that abortion is murder, how do you respond when people say that?
Well, first, I think it's a question of who gets to make the decision, because if you, again, like I said in the oral argument, if you look at the Constitution, it, and even the Bible, talks about when the first breath is taken, not when conception occurs. So I respect that there are some people who have that, you know, once conception occurs, that's it. But I still think it comes down to who gets to make that decision. And I just don't think it could be the government.
Do you ever think abortion will stop being controversial in America?
I would like to think that. I'm not sure I do.
Well, Sarah Weddington, 44 years ago, successfully argued the Roe versus Wade case before the United States Supreme Court. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's been nice to be here, and I'm glad I'm leaving just before the snow.
And Sarah Weddington was honored yesterday at Harvard Law School in conjunction with International Women's Day. Special thank you to the Oye Project at the IIT Chicago Kent School of Law for the audio of that oral argument from Roe v. Wade. You can find a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.